WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Cherry Gross. The Cajun detective Dave Robichaud is the creation of my guest, James Lee Burke. His novels are set in New Orleans and the surrounding bayou. Joyce Carol Oates reviewed Burke's new book for The Washington Post. She included him among the gifted contemporary writers responsible for revitalizing the detective genre by bringing in issues of politics, gender, race, and morality. Oates writes, "Among even his talented contemporaries, Burke is something special." Burke got a late start in the field of crime fiction. His first novel was published in 1965, but he went through long periods when no one was interested in bringing out his books. One book was in play for 9 years and was rejected by 100 publishers. It wasn't until the mid-80s that Burke started writing detective novels. In his new novel, A Stained White Radiance, Dave Robichaud is investigating a Klansman-turned-politician and a TV evangelist. Here's a reading.
If you grew up in the Deep South, you're probably fond, as I am, of recalling the summertime barbecues and fish fries, the smoke drifting in the oak trees, the high school dances under a pavilion that was strung with Japanese lanterns, the innocent lust we discovered in convertibles by shattered lakes groaning with bullfrogs, and the sense that the season was eternal, that the world was a quiet and gentle place, that life was a party to be enjoyed with the same pleasure and certainty as the evening breeze that always carried with it the smell of lilac and magnolia and watermelons in a distant field. But there is another memory, too. The boys who went nigger-knocking in the little black community of Sunset, who shot people of color with BB guns and marbles fired from slingshots, who threw M-80s onto the galleries of their pitiful homes. Usually these boys had burr haircuts, jug ears, half-moons of dirt under their fingernails. They lived in an area of town with unpaved streets, garbage in the backyards, ditches full of mosquitoes and water moccasins from the coulee. Each morning they got up with their loss, their knowledge of who they were, and went to war with the rest of the world. When we meet the adult bigot, the Klansman, the anti-Semite, we assume that he was bred in that same wretched place. Sometimes that's a correct conclusion. Oftentimes it's not.
Do you know anybody who you grew up with who you feel became, as an adult, one of the kinds of fascists that you're writing about?
Oh, I knew many people who grew up to be like the boys that I describe here in this piece. But these kinds of people are victims themselves. These are fellas, or sometimes women too, who are inept and not quite functional and see themselves as being disenfranchised, and they never know who they are unless they feel superior to some other group, and they're by and large innocuous and bumbling guys with banana peels for fingers. It's hard to look upon them as villains. They're almost like buffoons rather than villainous people. The kind of individual who bothers me most is the one who's calculating, who knows better, and who is of insidious intent. The person who perhaps has sociopathic tendencies, who insinuates himself into the mainstream of society. And he has one message always. He teaches others to fear and to hate our fellow man, and to blame others for our own misfortune.
Now, Dave Robichaud, your detective, is drawn to people who are psychologically deformed in some way. I mean, he considers people like that to be like his extended family. The walking wounded, as he describes them. Is that an affinity you feel yourself?
Well, let's face it, who are the most interesting people in our midst? People who get up every morning and do things in a normal way, or the deeply neurotic and brain-fried, the people who begin each day with a nervous breakdown, people who were shot out of a cannon 5 minutes ago. I think they're always more intriguing. I don't know. I've always felt that it's difference that saves us from ourselves. I mean, God help us if we ever become too enamored with normalcy. It's always the person who has the outrageous and eccentric view of the world who leads us away from ourselves, always. Whether it's, we're talking about Newton or Christ or Socrates, it's always the person who does everything backwards, who says no to the status quo, that has something to say. Bernard Shaw once said, "We learn from the irrational man and woman. They reject the world as it is. They do not adapt themselves to it. They seek to change it.
I want to just quote a line from your new novelist, Stand White Radiance, and this is in a paragraph where Dave Robichaux, your detective, is talking about how his extended family is people who have a peculiar difference in their makeup. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about every time he thinks that some kind of constitutional sacrifice can be justified for the greater good, he wonders what his eccentric friends would say. And he says, then I realized that the rhetoric of the greater mm-hmm. good, would have no effect on them, because for those who were most deeply injured as children, words of moral purpose too often masked acts of cruelty.
That's right.
Tell me how that observation came to you.
Well, anyone who spends any time, with 12-step groups or in analytical therapy or analysis is going to discover something about the nature of cruelty and how oftentimes it masks itself as love. And we all, at some time in our lives, have to deal with the nature of power and authority. And so very often people who suffer the greatest psychological injury in their lives are those who were treated erratically as children, not in a way that was consistently abusive. They were often hurt in some way, psychologically, physically, but were constantly told that this was an act of love, that it was being done for the child's own good. That person grows up with his head in a microwave. And the consequence is, as a rule, he has trouble with authority, defining it. He may spend a lifetime rebelling against it, or he may embrace it. He probably will misuse power himself. And one theme in the book deals with how an injury done a child is like a stone bruise, and it perpetuates itself in the person's adult life, where the injury is compounded, and it. This is why, you know, forgiveness and atonement and reconciliation among ourselves, to my mind at least, is so important. That person doesn't have to play the hand he's dealt with. You can put it away and say, "How about 5 new cards?"
We were talking a little earlier about how crime fiction has really become the genre that's really about moral questions. Because the detective is always faced with moral questions and has to decide when it's just to kind of fudge things on the law and when it's not, and when just kind of analyzing the character of others and who is kind of morally just and who isn't, and so on. And it's also become like the novel of sensibility, because you're always seeing things through the detective's eyes. I wonder if, since writing crime fiction yourself, and it's only been, I think, less than 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
That you've been writing this detective series. Yeah. Have you started thinking more about, like, morality and ethics than you ever did before?
Well, that's a very good question. I think I've always written about the same kinds of people and situations, and I have never really made much of a distinction in kinds of writing, but I think your observation is just dead on correct. The contemporary crime novel, in many ways, is a form of primitive existentialism. The narrator, as you say, the is almost a direct descendant of Poe's protagonist, Edgar Allan Poe's protagonist, in that he's a kind of intellectual outsider who sees a moral dilemma and a contest between good and evil in a way that seems sometimes to have almost apocalyptical proportions, because the landscape he describes is one that is at war with itself.
So how do you see the world differently now, now that you have to be looking at it through the eyes of your detective Dave Robichaux?
Well, I don't think that I do. I subscribe to the notion that ultimately, all our problems have to be confronted individually. I don't believe in institutional solutions. I think that's part of our contemporary self-delusion. Anyone who's ever been a victim of violent crime knows what I'm talking about. As Dave Robichaux observes, many of these people tend to become NRA members. I'm not an NRA member.
You mentioned people who've been the victims of violent crime. Does that include you? Have you ever been a victim?
My family has.
Can I ask what happened, what kind of crime it was that affected your family?
Well, my story's not significant. Everyone who's ever been in that territory knows what I'm talking about.
I understand that you don't want to talk about the incident that happened to your family, but I had picked out a section where violence happens to, in the home of Dave Robichaux, mm-hmm. your detective, and this is a scene in the second novel mm-hmm. that you wrote, the second Dave Robichaux novel, Heaven's Prisoners, and this is a scene in which his wife is killed by mm-hmm. people who are really looking for him, mm-hmm. and I'd like for you to read that for
okay,
us.
Okay, thanks. This is the second novel, as you say, in the series. The first one was The Neon Rain. In the first three books of the series, The Neon Rain, Heaven's Prisoners, and Black Cherry Blues form a trilogy. And the second book is The Descent, really, into Dante's Ninth Ring, when Dave loses his wife, Annie. This book, by the way, is being made into a film. Alec Baldwin's playing the lead, and Harley Payton from Twin Peaks wrote the screenplay, the adaptation. I raced through the front door into the bedroom and hit the light switch, my heart thundering in my chest. Red shotgun shells littered the doorway area. The mahogany foot and headboards of the bed were gouged and splintered with buckshot and deer slugs. The flowered wallpaper above the bed was covered with holes like black dimes. The sheet, which still lay over her, was drenched with her blood, the torn cloth embedded in wounds that wolves might have chewed. Her curly blonde hair was turned away from me on the pillow. One immaculate white hand hung over the side of the mattress. I touched her foot. I touched her blood-flecked ankle. I put my hands around her fingers. I brushed my palm across her curly hair. I knelt like a child by the bed and kissed her eyes. I picked her hand up and put her fingers in my mouth. Then the shaking started, like sinew and bone separating inside me, and I pressed my face tightly into the pillow with my wet hair against her forehead. I don't know how long I knelt there. I don't remember getting up from my knees. I know that my skin burned as though someone had painted it with acid, that I couldn't draw enough air into my lungs, that the room's yellow light was like a flame to my eyes, that all my joints seem atrophied with age, that my hands were blocks of wood when I fumbled in the dresser drawer, found the .45 and pushed the heavy clip into the magazine. In my mind's eye, I was already running through the yard, across my neighbor's pasture, through the sloping woods of oak and pine on the far side, where the dirt road passed before it reached the drawbridge over the bayou.
Was that scene really hard to write?
Yeah, it sure was. That chapter was probably one of the most powerful that I ever wrote.
Because you must have felt this great affection for the character, as Dave did. I mean, you created her, and now you had decided that she had to die.
Well, I always feel the story is written in the unconscious.
Uh-huh.
That's always my feeling. I don't know how it's going. It's written somehow before the writer gets to it. And you discover the story as it unfolds day by day. It sounds a little schizoid, I'm afraid, but I believe that's about it.
My guest is James Lee Burke. He writes the Dave Robichaud detective novels. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is James Lee Burke, and he writes the Dave Robichaud crime novels, which are set in New Orleans. The new one is called A Stained White Radiance. I had read that you had an alcohol problem for a few years, and I was wondering if stopping coincided at all with your crime series and with the success of your fiction.
No. I belong to a 12-step fellowship today, but put it this way, through that fellowship, I learned a new point of view about many things. And the novels that have been very successful, the whole series narrated by Dave Robichaud, have as much to do with recovery as they do with social themes. And I receive hundreds of letters from people all over the country who tell me how much they received from the books, how much it helped them, or, in their opinion, how accurate the books are in describing recovery for people.
He's a recovering alcoholic.
Yeah, Dave is, sure. Yeah.
Was it helpful for you to have that character to write through some of the frustrations you might have been feeling and some of the cravings you might have had, you know, to kind of give it to the detective?
Well, is a catharsis? No, I appreciate your observation, but I don't think art is a catharsis. That therapists sometimes suggest that people paint or write. When I was teaching creative writing, some kid would sometimes enroll in my class and tell me the school counselor had concluded that he should take creative writing rather than be lobotomized. And I would think, gee, thanks a lot for sending this guy into my class. But you simply, as a novelist, chronicle in one way or another, you're part of your own experience. And if it's written correctly, honestly, it'll be an accurate representation of some of the psychological geography that people have to traverse.
I want to get back to your novel for a second.
Okay.
There's a group of characters who you describe in the novel as the pool.
Oh, yeah.
Let me ask you to describe the kind of person that you're talking about there and how you came up with that thought.
Well, I used to be a social worker in South Los Angeles, and the pool, these are the brain fried. These are the guys who, you know, arrive on this planet like, you know, a cannonball going through a stucco wall. They leave behind whole warehouses of paper, all kinds of records, parole and probation officers, marriage counselors, psychiatrists, social workers, bail bondsmen. These guys are the people with banana peels for fingers. And we think, my heavens, what are these guys doing in our society? But they provide employment for millions of other people, for guys like me who are social a guy like me who was a social worker. People who complain most about these guys would be bereft if they disappeared, if the pool went away somewhere. I mean, how about all our policemen and psychiatrists, marriage counselors? What are they going to do for a job? That's kind of on the light side, but...
But, you know, in a way, the way you're describing them, in a way, is not unlike the way you describe the kinds of eccentrics who
sure.
you're most interested in yeah. having as an almost extended family.
Yeah.
Are they the same people?
Sure. And I knew some great guys on Skid Row in Los Angeles. Yeah, East 5th Street, as Woody Guthrie once said, is the skiddiest of the skids. And there was this one guy, I won't use his name, but he was a master at manipulation. And he would come into the office and demand that we place him in our best hotels, you know, our welfare hotels. As soon as he checked in, he'd throw all the furniture out the window, box springs. One time he ripped the laboratory out of the wall. It'd come crashing, you know, down onto the cement from four stories high. And then he would run downstairs and haul it all to the secondhand store. This guy was—
Oh, to sell it.
To sell it. This guy was so infamous that in South L.A. the cops wouldn't arrest him because— This is kind of distasteful, but if they didn't cuff him right and he could get a finger down his throat, he'd throw up in the squad car.
Oh, God.
This guy was so awful, the jailer at Lincoln Heights didn't want him in his jail. He said, I couldn't take this guy anymore. This was, I mean, that's a victory, a guy that could undo the system the way this one man could.
So it sounds like your relationship with him was more of like a novelist to a character than a social
sure.
worker.
Sure. I knew hundreds of people like this guy, just truly extraordinary human beings.
Could you communicate with him?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Did you feel like you understood him?
Sure. And it's like any policeman will tell you that he knows many, many people like this man I describe. And that oftentimes there's a kind of symbiotic and sympathetic relationship between cops and certain kinds of people who inhabit the underworld. And they both sometimes understand the existentialistic rush that they get participating in a kind of nether society, a place that ordinary people don't put much time into, and that... You know, it's something interesting about being on the Full Tilt Boogie all the time.
So when people could sense in you that you were not the straightest guy in the world, you know what I mean? That you were kind of eccentric yourself.
Well, I don't know. Maybe.
But do you think that they would use that to try to take advantage of you?
No.
Or do you think that they would have more of a... feel more kind of sympathetic or affectionate toward you because of that?
Most people I knew in that world had a wink of the eye at mm-hmm. respectability, and if you could share it with them, they knew you both had a kind of a Sancho Panza view of things.
James Lee Burke, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Terry, on your show.
James Lee Burke's new book is called A Stained White Radiance. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.